From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Mina Kim, in for Michael Krasny. Coming up on Forum, many families in the North Bay woke up without power as the massive PG&E public safety power shutoffs got underway around midnight. More shutoffs are scheduled to begin in East Bay and South Bay counties at noon today. A staggering 800,000 people are expected to lose power in Northern California's largest mass blackout. In this hour forum, we hear how the power shutoff is affecting you, how well your city has prepared for it, and how effective the strategy of widespread power shutoffs is in preventing wildfires. Join us. Welcome to Forum. I'm Mina Kim, sitting in this morning for Michael Krasny. Portions of every Bay Area county besides San Francisco lost or will lose power, according to PG&E. They're among 34 counties losing power during what's likely the largest preemptive power shutoff in state history in an effort to reduce wildfire risk. PG&E equipment sparked last year's campfire, which killed 86 people and destroyed the town of Paradise. We're getting the latest on the impact of the shutoffs and how the Bay Area is coping. And we want to hear from you. How are you affected? The number to call, 866-733-6786. Again, 866-733-6786. Post your comments or questions on Facebook, Twitter, email us at forum@kqed.org or post them on our website. Joining me now is Lily Jamali. She is co-host and correspondent for KQED's The California Report. Good morning, Lily Jamali.
Good morning, Mina.
Also with us is Jeremy Siegel. He's a reporter and anchor for KQED News. Good morning, Jeremy Siegel.
Good morning, Mina.
And Jeremy, start by reminding us just how many people in the Bay Area are without power right now.
Yeah, so last night at about midnight, PG&E began instituting these preemptive power shutoffs. That's affecting, at this point, about 141,000 people in the Bay Area. And this is mostly in the North Bay. In Napa County, that's 32,750 customers. In Solano County, that's about 31,000 customers. And in Marin County, it's roughly 10,000 customers. And when we say customers here, we're referring to building units or businesses, not just a single person. So this is, you know, much likely way more than the number of customers I'm talking about here when you're looking at the number of people affected. And as you mentioned, this is just the first round of shutoffs. So as we go throughout the day, we're going to likely be seeing many more people throughout the state and especially in the Bay Area affected by these power outages.
Right. So what's supposed to happen at noon today, Jeremy?
At noon today, we're going to see more than 200,000 other customers be affected by these power shutoffs here in the Bay Area. That's every county in the Bay Area, except for San Francisco. This is going to be affecting parts of Oakland, parts of San Jose. And again, that's going to be around noon today. And, you know, city leaders, police forces in these cities, they're preparing for it. In Oakland, you know, Police Chief Ann Kirkpatrick has said they're staffing up increased patrols as a result of these shutoffs.
And remind us quickly, Jeremy, what were the conditions that prompted this massive power shutoff or the expected conditions?
Yeah, sure. So these are what we call red flag warnings, which is extremely dangerous fire weather conditions. And what we're seeing right now, or at least what we're going to be seeing way more of as we get to tonight and into early Thursday morning, is extremely gusty winds, especially in high peaks and areas in the North Bay and even into the valleys in the North Bay and the East Bay. And when you combine these strong gusty winds with relatively low humidity, and on top of that, a lot of dry vegetation, we're talking trees and grass that could catch fire really easily if something is sparked. That's what creates this extremely dangerous fire conditions. So PG&E is instituting these preemptive shutoffs to avoid the possibility of their equipment sparking one of those fires that could just easily get out of control with these conditions.
And Lily Jamali, Governor Newsom seemed to suggest that he understood people's frustration, their anger, their inconvenience around these public safety power shutoffs. You spoke with him yesterday. I want to just play a little bit of your interview with him.
Reality is that we want to protect people. We want to make sure that people are safe. This is what PG&E thinks is best interest of their customers and ultimately for this region.
So what happened? How is this allowed to stand?
Well, the determination of whether or not to do this is based on a number of factors. This is not novel in the industry. This is actually quite routine in the industry. You go down in San Diego region, which has one of the best life safety records of any utility in the country. They've been practicing this kind of strategy for years and years and years.
So what exactly is Governor Newsom saying here, that they had no choice to do this, but they didn't do it as well as they could have?
I think what he's saying is that this cannot be the new normal in the longer term, but that this is the best that PG&E appears to be able to do right now. I mean, he's looking at this through two lenses. There's the short term and the long term. In the short term, he's looking at how do we get through 2019 without another campfire or another North Bay firestorm? And if he can get through that, I think that would be a short-term success in his view. But longer term, his goal is how do we get PG&E, rather, out of bankruptcy? How do we make sure that they have the money and the resources to fix their system, which is antiquated? Whether you ask Governor Newsom, whether you even talk to the PG&E CEO, they will tell you that the system needs serious upgrades. And it's not a good look for this to be the new normal. I've been able to talk to some local officials as well, and this is very frustrating for people who are dealing with this on the ground, because the scope of these shutoffs is so vast that it's almost made it overwhelming for them to target how to deal with this.
What were some of the specific things that you were hearing from which local officials?
So I spoke with Butte County Supervisor Doug Teeter, who was one of the people who unfortunately lost his home in Paradise last year. And, you know, he echoed something I've heard from a number of people, which is, you know, this is not how the fifth largest economy in the world should be dealing with wildfire. You know, he talked about how this is a third world approach to a, you know, very serious concern that we've known has been in the works for a while. I mean, going into this fire season, we knew how serious the scope of a potential fire could be based on what we saw in 2017 and 2018. And I think that what they've been doing in places like Butte County is relying on the things that they have seen, the patterns that they've gleaned from the shutoffs that happened in June, that happened in September, and even just this past weekend. Instead of getting information from PG&E, they're really kind of just relying on what they've seen in terms of what specific locations in the area being earmarked as up for grabs by PG&E. Where are those shutoffs actually happening, not where are the warnings happening?
And Jeremy Siegel, you mentioned Oakland. You mentioned Police Chief Kirkpatrick, that she's trying to assure residents in Oakland that they are on it, that they are aware that this could cause some problems. So what exactly is she concerned with?
Well, I mean, I think the specifics are difficult, but it's that when there is an event of this magnitude that is going to be affecting cities across the Bay Area, there's just a lot of confusion among your residents. I mean, you know, people don't know exactly what it's going to be like once these power outages are instituted in cities like Oakland and San Jose come noon. And, you know, a lot of that confusion is coming from the fact that PG&E has maps available where you can see whether your home is affected by this. But also PG&E has been having a lot of difficulty with their site. You know, it's sort of hit or miss when you type in PG&E.com or go to one of these pages that they send out where you can check if your home's affected, whether the website's going to even work. So I think it mostly comes from confusion on what it's going to be like and even whether people are going to be affected by these shutoffs.
Well, we've got a lot of calls coming in. I'm going to start with Kevin in Martinez. Hi, Kevin.
Hello there. Yeah, so I think I just caught the tail end of your guest comment. Yeah, this is a huge event, no doubt about it. You know, it seems like PG&E had, you know, sufficient time to be prepared for this. But yet today, when I'm visiting the outage map on their website, it's down. There's no way to actually see. I mean, I happen to know that I'm in an area that's close, but to me, that just further demonstrates how unprepared PG&E is here to not have sufficient bandwidth to accommodate the massive amount of traffic that they'll be getting to their website. That's just unacceptable.
Yes, Kevin, thanks. And I think PG&E will need to add that to the list of fixes the next time around. Jeremy Siegel?
Yeah, and I think, you know, what you're seeing as a result of this is that some local jurisdictions, some counties are trying to take some of this notification work into their own hands. Like people who are living in Alameda County, who are living in Napa County, they're getting NICSIL alerts from the local sheriff's department there. So I think what you're seeing as PG&E's website might be down and people might be frustrated with the lack of information there, that local jurisdictions are having to step up and give people notifications. That being said, you might end up getting more broad notifications than, you know, might be necessary for you knowing what's happening. For example, you might be in Alameda County and get a notification saying that there are going to be preemptive shutoffs. That doesn't necessarily mean that your address is going to have a power shutoff. They're probably giving more broad alerts than necessary.
Exactly. There were the PG&E website very early yesterday mentioned that my home would not be impacted, but then later some maps and other entities that were trying to help people navigate whether or not they would be affected seemed to suggest that my home would be. Mm-hmm. You try to go back to confirm it at the best source, and that's the website, and the website is down, and hence Kevin's frustration. And Lily Jamali, you wanted to add something.
Yeah, I know that last night PG&E on that media call, I know Jeremy was a part of that as well, addressed the issue that they've been having with their website. They've said that traffic is up by about 7 or 8 times compared to normal, and that they've tried to double their bandwidth in order to deal with this. But all yesterday, it was spotty. Even this morning, I'm having trouble logging on. And I think at one point yesterday, they said, oh, you know, our Twitter page is being regularly updated. You know, think about what percentage of the population uses Twitter. How accessible is that to some of the more vulnerable populations that we're talking about, whether it's the elderly? And plus, you know, if you don't have power, how do you even log on? We had an event where I live in Alameda County about 2 Sundays ago for just a few hours. And, you know, you couldn't log on to the internet with your phone, certainly not with your computer. You could make phone calls. And so it just kind of drives home how incredibly difficult it is to access extremely important information under these conditions.
And we are joined now by Daniel Swain. He's a climate scientist at UCLA and the National Center for Atmospheric Research. Good morning, Daniel Swain.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for being on. So we are getting and noticing that it doesn't seem to be incredibly windy out there. I'm just going to read a couple of comments we've gotten from listeners. Bonnie, for example, tweets, hard to fathom the red flag conditions when it's a light breeze in most of Sonoma County currently and forecasted. And Terry tweets, isn't a massive power outage considered a disaster, maybe even a state emergency? There's no dangerous fire weather in the area. Temps are in the low 80s. Winds no more than 11 miles per hour. And so, Daniel Swain, are these high winds materializing as you expected?
Well, I think that there's a lot of consternation about this power shutoff and the context of this extreme fire weather event, because the warnings and the advisories all went into effect in advance of the actual winds materializing. So
yes,
actually, all of the official forecasts call for winds to ramp up later today.
And so, based on that, I mean, so you're saying that you trust the meteorologist's predictions that the winds will grow dire over the course of today?
Yeah, so there's a little bit of complexity there. So the forecast is essentially from the National Weather Service calling for much stronger winds later today and into tonight over the regions that typically are favored during these strong offshore wind events. And by that, I mean typically not the dense urban areas near sea level in the Bay Area and throughout Northern California, but especially in the hills and in the Central Valley. So we're talking about winds 50, 60, maybe even more miles per hour in these regions, in the mountain areas in particular. And that's actually where a lot of the power lines are that have been powered down. Unfortunately, that extends the power outages even into areas that aren't necessarily going to be experiencing the extreme winds.
Right. But there was some talk, and maybe you're saying this is not an official forecast, that after 4 a.m. this morning, that winds were supposed to pick up quite a bit. I guess I'm just wondering if that happened.
Well, the winds are definitely picking up in the hills. I'm looking right now at observations of winds picking up to over 40 miles an hour right now in the hills, which I think will probably continue to increase later today, and they will probably start to extend to lower elevations as well. Although, you know, I'm not necessarily the point person for the operational forecast on this event. I think that in large part, it just hasn't started yet.
Yeah. So how effective do you think this strategy is at preventing wildfires?
Well, I think that's a complicated question because, on the one hand, we do know that a significant number of the really catastrophic wildfires that California has seen in the last few years have been sparked by power lines during high wind events, either something falling on the lines and causing an arc, or just the lines being blown into the dry brush by the high winds. And so clearly it is a major source of sparks during these extreme fire weather events that can have really catastrophic consequences. So by powering down those lines, you do eliminate the potential for those particular lines to start a fire at those particular times. Of course, there are other ways to spark fires. Power lines are not far from the only way. The largest fire in state history last year, the Ranch Fire, was started by a person hammering a stake into the ground. And the Car Fire up by Reading last summer was sparked by essentially someone's flat tire on their car. So even though it eliminates one major source of ignitions, it certainly doesn't eliminate all of them. And it does, at least in some circumstances, potentially lead to new ignition sources if people are, for example, firing up their gas-powered generators in the foothills or using candles for light or fireplaces for warmth at night. These are things that, you know, there are some real costs to consider as well as the potential benefits.
Well, Katarina asks, how many times this year is this expected to happen? Is this week just a rare event, Daniel Swain?
Yeah, that's a really good question, because we've seen a few of these power shutoffs, these public safety power shutoffs already this year, much smaller in geographic scope, so most people didn't notice them. But there have already been a few during lesser red flag events. And the current wind event that is projected to peak later today into tonight is pretty strong. It is probably the strongest we've seen in a couple of years. In fact, the Weather Service Office in San Francisco has pointed out it's probably the strongest since the October 2017 fires in North Bay that were so devastating. So I think there's a little bit of collective anxiety because of the similarities between this event and that event. So I can understand why there is so much concern. But on the other hand, this is far from an unprecedented, you know, fire weather event. We do tend to see strong wind events in autumn in California when the vegetation is still very dry. So while it's pretty strong, it is in some ways very characteristic of the kinds of patterns historically that lead to extreme fire conditions in this part of the world.
Well, David asks, why aren't the relief centers open after sundown? Don't people still need to go to the bathroom, charge their phones to reach family, and work at night? Jeremy Siegel, PG&E, was opening up some centers, some charging stations, some cooling centers if the temperatures get high. Can you address David's question about how effective these will be in addressing people's needs?
I think that's a great question, and I don't necessarily have a good answer about the hours, but that's a great concern and a great question there. These centers are going to be offering, you know, air conditioning, seating for, I think, up to 100, maybe more than 100 people. And they're also going to have chargers for your phones and such where you can get notifications about these shutoffs and potential dangerous fire conditions. On top of that, we're also seeing cities announce that they're opening centers on top of what PG&E is doing. So PG&E, I think, you know, has maybe one or two in the different areas that are affected. But on top of that, you're seeing, you know, Mayor Sam Liccardo of San Jose announcing that they're opening multiple centers in parts of San Jose to help their residents. So it's sort of an all hands on deck situation. And I think more people than PG&E are also offering these services.
I mean, part of the consternation too, Lily Jamali, is that there is no estimated time for power restoration, or at least that was the last word I got from my county emergency services. And so when is this shutoff event supposed to end? Do you have any sense or insight? Are you getting anything?
This is actually one of the areas that concerns me the most, because I was talking to my mom who's in Walnut Creek, and she said, well, you know, the wind is supposed to die down by tomorrow, so I guess it's only going to be 24 hours. And I said, no, we don't know that. We could well be in a position where PG&E is still inspecting its lines for days after the worst of the wind conditions go away.
Before they can power them back
before
up.
Before they can
yes.
power them back up. And we don't know how long that takes. This is a pretty arduous process. There's a combination of, you know, up in the air, you know, helicopter inspections happening along with on the ground observation that's involved. I think that's been really hard, because in theory, this is a one day, you know, condition. But we're hearing, as you say, you know, up to 5 days, up to 7 days. It's very unclear.
Yes.
And that's actually what is concerning because it makes it harder for people to prepare. If they really think it's a one-day event, one and done, I think that that can really prompt people to be less prepared for a longer-term issue than they might otherwise
be. And for all the people who have experienced power outages and disaster situations or from the wildfires in previous years, they know that one day makes a massive difference in terms of how long you are without power. Let me go to Rob in Los Gatos. Hi, Rob.
How's it going?
Great. What's on your mind?
So this whole thing has just been drummed up by PG&E so that they can get us angry enough or scared enough to put pressure on Gavin Newsom and the legislature to throw money at PG&E when our rates that we've been paying exorbitant fees for the last, last few decades, should have gone to pay for the infrastructure upgrade in the first place. Why is anyone believing that this is really what we need to do? We need to turn off the power. This is just a deflection that the fact that they killed almost 100 people last year through their negligence.
Rob, thank you. I want to get Daniel Swain's reaction to what you're saying, because Daniel Swain, I mean, yes, while there are weather conditions that ignite fires and they can push over trees or they can push over poles, right? Doesn't PG&E bear a lot of responsibility for not maintaining those poles properly or not maintaining the vegetation around them? And is this a way of basically us paying for that lack of maintenance, for that negligence?
Well, you know, I'm not a public policy expert, and I'm certainly not an expert in PG&E's historical maintenance policies. There certainly is some evidence that there has been a lot of deferred maintenance that probably could have prevented at least some of the fire events that have occurred in recent years. But I think, you know, the broader issue is generally something that I agree with, which is that this is not a good solution, not a long-term solution to any of the deeper underlying problems mm-hmm. surrounding wildfire risk in California. And you know, in some ways, it's a necessary bad idea, I think, in the short term, and because we are in a kind of a difficult and not so great situation in California, where, you know, we know that the wildfire risk has increased dramatically in recent years, and we've seen the unfortunate results of that in Paradise and in Santa Rosa and elsewhere. And you know, these power shutoffs are in some cases there is a good chance that they will eventually prevent another catastrophe. But on the other hand, they have very steep costs. Not just inconveniences, but there are really profound concerns about the impacts on local communities and how there is sort of this shifting of the costs from this utility to local communities in a way that's inequitable.
And we'll hear more about those after the break. We're talking with Daniel Swain, a climate scientist at UCLA and the National Center for Atmospheric Research. We've got Lily Jamali with us of KQED's California Report and Jeremy Siegel of KQED News. And you, our listeners, call us at 866-733-6786 with your questions, your stories, your experiences. You can also post your comments on Facebook, Twitter, our website, or email us at forum@kqed.org. I'm Mina Kim. Stay with us. You're listening to Forum. I'm Mina Kim. Some Bay Area residents woke up with no power this morning as the massive PG&E power shutoffs got underway after midnight. There is no estimated time for power restoration yet. Others in the Bay Area are bracing for their power to be turned off at noon today. All told, an astonishing 800,000 people are expected to lose power in 34 counties in Northern California. And we want to know how this has affected you. What questions or comments do you have about the strategy to prevent wildfires, about the weather conditions? How has your community handled the blackout? How well are your city leaders preparing for this? 866-733-6786 is the number to call, or post your comments on Facebook, on Twitter at KQED Forum, our website, or email us at forum@kqed.org. We've got Jeremy Siegel with us, a reporter and anchor for KQED News, Lily Jamali, co-host and correspondent of KQED's The California Report, and Daniel Swain, climate scientist at UCLA and the National Center for Atmospheric Research. And of course, you, our listeners. Jose asks, the power is supposed to go out in San Jose where I live at noon. I drive a truck for a living, so what happens if I cannot fuel my truck? The government or PG&E pays 100% of my lost income? We're joined on the line now by Diane Dillon. She's a supervisor for Napa County. Hello, Diane Dillon.
Hello.
Thanks so much for joining us. First of all, can you tell us how the power shutoff is playing out in your area? I know you represent Calistoga, but also you're a supervisor for the county.
Well, we have thousands of people without power. We've had some challenges with regard to some of our government buildings, but those appear to be resolved this morning. And we're very concerned about how long this is going to be for some of the reasons I just heard you say. People, the question that was asked by the caller, lost income and so forth.
Yes, it's hard to wrap your mind around the economic impact of this at this point, but clearly it is massive, even just alone from people who are unable to go to work today because either their children's schools have been shut down or their workplaces will not be functional or they just aren't able to do their jobs without power. Supervisor Dillon, why has it come to this, that we need to have this massive blackout to be able to avoid wildfires in your view?
In my view, it's because PG&E failed to do the vegetation management for more than 30 years that they should have done to protect their infrastructure. This is more about protecting their liability for causing a fire as much as it is for protecting our safety if a fire were to result from their failure to maintain their infrastructure. And I think the real struggle that we're having at the local government level is that the taxpayers are paying for the costs that local government is incurring. All 34 of these affected counties are probably opening up their emergency operations center, just as we did. Yes. That's staff time, a lot of other costs involved. We're setting up charging centers. And so it's not even the shareholders or the ratepayers that are paying for the disruption. And this public funds being used for an investor-owned utility's failure to take care of their infrastructure is one of the biggest challenges we have as local government, because we do respond, but we are not technically responsible for what's happening.
Calistoga experienced a blackout for several days last year, and at that time you told PG&E they could do better. What do you need them to do better, and are they doing it this time around?
What they need to do better is engage with us. They're in a whole new world. De-energization is something, especially at this massive scale, it's an endeavor in which they've never been involved before. And we are responsible, or we become de facto responsible for many people who cannot function without electricity, many medically vulnerable people, just as an example. We want PG&E to work with us. It's counties that have public health officers and social welfare systems to help with these situations. And PG&E takes an approach, a very standoff approach, and it's been very frustrating to get them to understand how this affects us and how we would like to work with them. I've said to several PG&E officials, you're not in the public welfare business. We are. Let us help you with how this de-energization process works.
And what is your message to those counties that are about to experience this come noon today, the residents there, in terms of the most important thing they can do based on your experience?
They need to be prepared to be self-sufficient for 72 hours at a minimum, preferably a week. I think it's really important to remember that, yes, this minimizes the chance that a wildfire will start, but it doesn't eliminate it. People still need to be prepared to leave if a wildfire does happen, because we have the dry conditions, we have the low humidity, the fuel is very susceptible to fire. So this doesn't mean a fire, de-energization does not mean a fire won't start. And I think we have, there's a concern that people will get a little complacent about the big picture.
Napa County Supervisor Diane Dillon, thanks for talking with us.
Thank you.
And we go to more listener comments. This listener writes, why not place the lines underground? This is Lisa. Lisa asks, certainly the cost will be less than rebuilding all these communities, the lawsuits and insurance payments. Not only that, but there is a fund specifically for that purpose. Daniel Swain, do you have any insights into putting these lines underground, what that actually means and what it would require?
Well, you know, I'm not an expert in the economics of the energy system, but it is my understanding that it is essentially very expensive to put power lines underground. It is certainly possible, and it probably would provide more of a long-term solution to the problem, at least in certain regions. But it's my understanding that this is a very expensive endeavor that I think individual utilities might not be inclined to take on their own. And I think, in the future, what might happen in some of these high-risk regions, which is to say the regions, these high-wind corridors, where we also have these high-tension power lines in the forest, those might be good candidates for putting those lines in those specific limited regions underground to potentially avoid some of these shutdowns in urban areas, even when the winds in those urban areas aren't especially extreme.
Daniel Swin, I know you need to leave us, but I just want to ask you before you go, in these volatile times when climate change is upon us and the questions that we have about the best ways to address the potential changes that we're about to see, what do you foresee in terms of our future around these wildfire situations and weather patterns? And what do you think is the best strategy if you could implement a strategy for the state of California?
Well, I think, I think what we're coming up against is a regional example, a pretty stark one of what happens when we are reactive in our adaptation to not just climate change, although that's part of it, but just changing risks in the social and environmental realm. And what we're sort of grappling with in California right now is that there have been really shocking recent catastrophes and tragedies with respect to wildfire. And this particular intervention of these public safety power shutoffs is one reactive approach to us, a part of the problem that has recently been in people's minds, but is in actuality, in the broader sense, a pretty small part of the overall problem of wildfire in a warming and increasingly populated California. And so, while these public safety shutoffs are arguably necessary as a short-term emergency stopgap measure to prevent some of these catastrophic events, it is really not a good long-term solution and can't be a permanent solution in a warming California, partly because or largely because of the inequities in how the costs are shared. And, this is essentially an example of a private utility in some ways offloading a lot of these costs onto vulnerable communities, people who, not just lose power as a matter of inconvenience, but people who depend on electrically powered medical devices, people who will lose all the food in their refrigerator this week, including people on public assistance programs, which don't have accommodations for losing your food during a power outage, for example. Yes. So there's all these sorts of potentially unintended consequences that stem from a particular reactive intervention. And I think hopefully we can learn some constructive lessons for this, for how we adapt to further changes in the future.
Daniel Swain, climate scientist at UCLA and the National Center for Atmospheric Research. Really appreciate having you on with us today.
Thanks again for having me on, and stay safe out there.
Yes, that is a message for all of our listeners. And Jeremy Siegel, Daniel Swain laid out some of the costs associated with a major power shutoff, with medical devices and food and all those risks. The other big risk is communication actually being down during these times, because you need power, as Lily Jamali was pointing out, to be able to use your phones or even get cell service, right? Because this listener tweets, please talk about connectivity issues. Comcast is down in Sonoma. What about cellular service? How do we get info? So how are cell towers affected by a power shutoff, a PG&E power shutoff, Jeremy Siegel?
That's a great question. And a lot of these cell towers do usually rely on Pacific Gas and Electric's power to power their cell towers. That being said, most of the major providers are saying that they do not expect this to have any major impacts on their service. That's because they have backups upon backups in place to help them keep power up and running at these times. They have generators, and then on top of that, they have backup generators. So they don't expect that people should be losing service during these blackouts. But, you know, there's no predicting how that might actually pan out. And it's a super valid concern because, as Daniel Swain was saying, PG&E lines aren't the only thing that spark wildfires. So while PG&E lines might be shut down and you've reduced that risk, the conditions are still extremely dangerous or potentially extremely dangerous, and you could have a wildfire. And if people are having difficulty communicating with one another, getting emergency alerts, that can make an evacuation very difficult. Also, things like, you know, there's been a lot of conflicting information about the closure potentially of the Caldecott Tunnel.
Yes.
We've seen, you know, some firefighter unions say this could be a problem because that could impede our ability to get to areas to work on fires in the event that something like that were closed. So, you know, these can have very broad impacts on communication and on response to these emergency events.
I don't know if you've been able to cover the Caldecott with everything else that you've been covering, Jeremy Siegel, but there has been a question mark about whether or not it will need to close midday today because the power will be out, and whether or not they can get these backup generators going to keep the Caldecott Tunnel open was a question mark before this segment began. Have you heard anything?
I don't have an update at this point. I mean, what I've been hearing, and last night we were getting conflicting press releases from Caltrans initially saying that because of this shutdown event, they were going to have to close it. And then we were hearing that they weren't going to have to close it because of keeping backup generators up. At this point, what I've been hearing is that people who are driving in that area are seeing signs that say this tunnel might be closed around noon today. And I think whether or not it is closed is dependent on whether PG&E is able to help them indeed get these backup generators up and powered to light the tunnel.
And I'm just getting word from our incredible forum producer team that Caltrans is expected to update people at a 10:30 press conference. So that is the latest on that. Let me go to the phones again. I'll go next to Lydia in Santa Rosa. Hi, Lydia.
Hi. First of all, I wanted to make a comment about safety, but I wanted to preface it by saying that my view is that Governor Newsom should not have accepted PG&E's short-term conclusion. I think they should have gone back to the drawing board, because if we extend this logic, that is to say that zero electricity equals zero fires, and that puts us back into some sort of antiquated times, and that flies in the face of the fact that California is one of the most progressive states in America. So specifically, I wanted to talk about the safety of the residents. Now, I'm in Santa Rosa, and our electricity is due to be shut off somewhere around noon, but we don't have the exact time. But I wanted to talk about the cell phones. It jeopardizes the safety of the residents if you cannot if you cannot dial 911. Now, most people don't have landlines, and I know that after 24 hours, my cell phone is kind of iffy, and if I still don't have electricity to recharge it, I don't have any way of calling in any kind of an emergency. That is number one, and I know that Calistoga and San Jose have set up centers for charging, but if we think about it, there's thousands of people who have cell phones. That's kind of impractical to expect that people will spend hours and hours at the cell phone charging areas charging their cell phones just in order to live the normal life again. The other part of safety is the fact that it does interrupt a lot of different aspects of life.
Yes.
Besides the cell phone, a lot of security alarms of businesses, institutions, and businesses are interrupted. The schools have been shut down, and that interrupts the flow of education. It's very difficult. Well, much more difficult to teach a child when you've got 2-3 days and then they have 3 days off and then you come back and you've got 2-3 days to teach them than it is to have consecutive days.
Well, Lydia, I think you've really laid out the ripple effects and underscored some of the other concerns that we've heard about safety. And I actually really appreciate you bringing in the schools into this. I understand KQED's Julia McAvoy is with us. She is senior editor for KQED News, and she focuses on education. Julia McAvoy, good morning.
Good morning, Mina.
So what are you hearing in terms of school closures?
Well, it's all over the map, depending on where you live. In Oakland, it turns out that only Skyline High School is closed. That's affecting about 1,800 students there. But if you head up to Sonoma County, there are about 34,000 students who will not be in school today because of the closures, according to the county superintendent there. So it is from junior colleges, Santa Rosa Junior College is closed, to Mills College, a private college in Oakland, to UC Berkeley. So we have, you know, parents and kids all over the Bay Area being challenged by the by these closures. And you know, Mina, as a working parent yourself, how that can hit you as a last-minute scramble trying to make plans for your kids.
Yes, shout out to my neighbors who've taken my daughters this morning. but you're right, the ripple effect of the scramble, and childcare is not affordable for a lot of people as well. After-school programs are also not available in many of the locations where schools are closed. So, Julia, thanks for that update.
Yeah, I mean, we have the school districts have been saying, look, we're trying to get word out early to everybody so that they can make plans, right? They understand that parents need time to lay out what they're going to do. And I know that some Skyline parents, including my brother, was networking with other parents to find out, hey, is your electricity going to be on? Because if so, why don't we drop our daughters off at your house? So people are doing that sort of thing. When it comes to Sonoma, you know, Mina, they've been through this before.
Yes.
With the Tubbs fire, and the county superintendent of schools there, Steve Harrington, he has developed all sorts of protocols for what schools need to do in the face of even a potential shutdown. And they had this thing, they went through this thing with PG&E just 2 weeks ago, actually, where, like, down to the wire at 9 p.m., a school called Ribley with some 400 students in the Mark West area, which got burned, you know, 2 years ago, were on alert that they would have their electricity shut off. And then at the last minute, they didn't. But Harrington has really got, you know, everything in place. And for rural schools, Mina, it's even more complicated. You know, there are schools that have to pump well water in advance, you know, for the electricity going down. And then it ripples out to just traffic safety and getting kids to and from school safely if the traffic lights are out. Those are the kinds of considerations that principals have to think about when PG&E is threatening to shut off the power.
Julia McAvoy, senior editor for KQED News. Thanks, Julia.
You're welcome.
Well, Thomas writes, PG&E can call it whatever they want, but it's just a return to an era of rolling blackouts. Joe writes, from all of us PG&E electric workers out in the field, we are all so sorry this is happening to everyone. We normally work tirelessly to keep the power on or get it back on as soon as possible. Please, everyone, remember, it's not the field workers doing this, and we will be doing our best, I promise. Joe, thank you for that. We appreciate what you are trying to do out there, and maybe we should take Andy's advice. Andy's a listener who writes, call your state representative and get them to fix this ridiculous situation. I'd rather have my power off than people's homes burn, but I'd much rather have an electric grid that didn't start fires. We're getting some advice from the Red Cross. They recommend that if you're using a generator, to please be sure you understand the risks of carbon monoxide and how to use generators safely. This is so true, Lily Jamali, in terms of the cost-benefit analysis of, you know, whether or not you should do a power outage, because generators can also be fire hazards. In terms of food safety, quickly, an unopened refrigerator will keep foods cold for about 4 hours. A full freezer will keep the temperature for about 48 hours. 24 hours if it is half full and the door remains closed. So we don't also want to see a public health spike in foodborne illnesses as well. So please heed this advice. Lily Jamali, I think the questions that are really swirling around all of this right now is this step by PG&E worth it, especially against the context of everything that they are asking of the taxpayers and of the state itself, right, as connected to taxpayers. So can you just remind us the pickle that PG&E is in with the state?
Yeah, well, it's good to hear from Joe, because when I talk to county officials and local officials, they are often very careful to say, this is not an issue with the workers on the ground. This is our issue with PG&E corporate and their management of this system for years. I think, you know, your question is a good one. Is the cost of shielding itself as a corporation from these liabilities in this way too extreme? Is too much of the burden ending up on the shoulders of everyday Californians, on taxpayers and ratepayers? And are they leaving people behind, these more medically vulnerable folks or elderly folks, to make sure that they don't spark a fire and, you know, end up hurting a lot more people? You know, I think that this is a question that is going to be something we grapple with for many months and possibly years to come. I know that Butte County right now is drafting a letter to the CPUC, which is PG&E's regulator, and they're asking, what is PG&E doing to move away from this method, these shutoffs? What work is being done? What progress are they making to develop the kind of labor force that's needed to harden its infrastructure? And, you know, I go back to the exchange that I had with Governor Newsom yesterday with a number of other reporters, and you realize there's no political prize for preventing a fire. There are only political consequences when one happens. And I think that that is a really hard square to circle. I also spoke with the state Senate President Pro Tem Tony Atkins, who said, we don't want to be the first to say to PG&E, you're going too broad, you're being too expansive, because if a fire happens, then again, you know, the question becomes, nobody wants this liability on their hands, including the politicians in Sacramento. But of course, they also don't want power shutoffs when there doesn't need to be a power shutoff. And that's really where the tension lies, especially on a day like today when these shutoffs are as vast as they are. Are we doing too much when these shutoffs could be more surgical, more specific? And I think that would give local officials an opportunity to respond more appropriately, more specifically, and help the people who really need it.
Well, let me go to another listener. That's Tony in Petaluma. Hi, Tony.
Hey, good morning.
Good morning. Go ahead.
Well, you know, in response to one of the ladies commented earlier about, you know, my wife and I went through those fires in 2017. We live in St. Helena, and the power was out for many days. And I was just using my truck to charge our cell phones. But also, Makita and Milwaukee Tool Corporation make a little adapter that fits on top of a cordless lithium battery. And you can charge two cell phones or whatever you need to charge, iPad, whatever. And these things are under $20. And I have a couple of them. And I keep one in my truck, and I keep one in my house, because they are invaluable when you run out of juice for any particular reason or an emergency. You have a power source, and even if your battery doesn't have enough power to run a power tool, it doesn't take much to charge a cell phone. These things they're worth their weight in gold, I'm telling you.
Well, thanks for that tip, Tony. We really appreciate it. Certainly, we need to get practical advice as well as look at the big picture. Justin in San Ramon, what would you like to say? Thanks for joining us.
Oh, thank you. If PG&E does this once, they'll probably do it again. So long-term, instead of asking PG&E what they can do, what can we do to get away from PG&E? Mm-hmm. Can cities build their own grids? Can we force PG&E to decentralize their grids so that if people want to live in high-risk areas, it won't affect urban areas? And I'll listen off the air. Thank you.
Thanks, Justin. That's the ideal, right, Lily Jamali, for people to be able to have more control over their own grid and also use clean power.
Yeah. And also, you know, the issue of municipalization comes up in this context a lot. San Francisco is trying to get PG&E to go away on its territory. They're saying, here's $2.5 billion. Let's run this thing ourselves. We think we can do it better. I know San Jose is looking at that possibility. I think there's something very disempowering about a moment like this, and it does spark conversations about taking the grid back or going the route of a community choice aggregation, which doesn't mean that PG&E is no longer operating the grid. It just means who you're buying your power from is different. But, you know, I think what's very unsettling to people in a moment like this is that PG&E, a for-profit corporation, is ultimately making the call on whether these shutoffs happen. And so that's where municipalization for critics becomes a very attractive proposition.
And this question of oversight of PG&E has always been one that has been very fraught and questionable. Back to some of the more practical questions, Jeremy Siegel. Carrie writes, Actually, she's making a comment here. She writes, I'm a disaster preparedness instructor for the city of Berkeley, and I'm amazed at the public's response concerning this shutdown. Yes, it's a bad situation, but when the big one hits, there will be no warning at all. The bottom line is spend time getting yourself educated and prepared. This other listener writes, will the affected areas change? Once we check the maps for power shutoffs, do we need to keep checking it for updates? Jeremy, I know that the PG&E website, when it was working, said to check back every few hours. Do we still have to keep doing that?
Mm-hmm. It's always a fluid situation if you speak to PG&E. I mean, these maps, I think, are fairly accurate for planning purposes looking forward. But they will say because fire conditions change, because things might change on the ground, it is slightly up in the air. So it is a good idea to keep checking back on PG&E's website if you can. Check their Twitter and also look out for alerts from your local county.
And Lee writes, I have not seen public service announcements on TV or heard on radio to advise people how to prepare. Why not? Lots of talk about PG&E, not enough about preparation. Lee, I would direct you to our website if you can get to it, which has a great list of ways to prepare that are from PG&E, but also recommendations from other local officials. But if Lily or Jeremy, in the last minute that we have, want to just give out just a couple of more pieces of advice for how to prepare for this.
Yeah, sure. I mean, Jeremy one Siegel. Thing that people might not expect to be a great idea, but, you know, if you are in Alameda County, if you're in Santa Clara County, charge your laptop ahead of time, and you can use that and plug a USB port in to charge your phone, and that'll be really important for staying in the loop and potentially getting notifications for an emergency.
Keep cash handy. Make sure you fill up your tank.
And we will continue to try to take some more questions after this break. So for those of you who are listening, we are talking about the PG&E power shutoffs across Northern California that began between midnight and 4 a.m. Wednesday. I'm Mina Kim. You're listening to Forum. Stay tuned.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.